Teachers and Writers Collaborative on WNYE-FM presents Fiction in the Morning. I am Anne Whitehouse, and today I am reading a chapter from my novel, Fall Love. None of the chapters in this novel have names, but if they did, this one would be called Art Lessons. It is exclusively about Althea, one of four main characters, a tall blonde woman in her mid-twenties who grew up in Connecticut and is now trying to survive as an artist in New York City. The novel chronicles Althea's struggles to create art, to establish herself as an artist, and to make a living as an arts teacher to children in the New York City public schools. The novel begins in August of 1980, when Althea, on vacation on Block Island, begins a new cycle of paintings. Then she entertains a visitor and falls in love. Unfortunately, her love turns out to be unhappy because it is not really reciprocated, as she learns when she returns to New York City and is instantly dropped. Complications with a friend add to Althea's problems and cause further estrangements. Althea's creative will is paralyzed, she is unable to paint at all, and her dread of failing to realize the paintings she has begun is so great that she has put them away in a closet and refuses even to look at them.
I'm sorry, could I ask you to take that sentence again? You were like clearing your throat when you said, and her paintings are...
Okay. I'm sorry. Althea's creative will is paralyzed. She is unable to paint at all, and her dread of failing to realize the painting she has begun is so great that she has put them away in a closet and refuses even to look at them. What frees her is the passage of time and the life lessons she experiences that lead to changes in herself. Some of these happen in her teaching, and here I would like to interject that I worked for many years as a writer in residence in many schools for Teachers and Writers Collaborative, including the time period covered by this novel, and I drew on my own experiences to write about Althea teaching art. By the time the chapter I am about to read occurs, Althea's recovery is almost complete. She is resigned to the reality that her love is over, and she has gone back to her paintings with a new burst of creativity. This creativity is fueled by her complicated reactions to an injury suffered by her former lover, which has ended his career as a modern dancer, just as it was beginning to blossom. Now, Althea seems to be on the ascendant, while Paul is descending. The chapter describes a visit that Althea makes to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in early December of that same year of 1980, where she views an exhibit on the Italian Renaissance and listens to a lecture by a renowned art conservator. This distinguished speaker should have an English accent, but I am unable to imitate one, so listeners will have to imagine it. While she is in the museum, Althea's thoughts wander back to her very recent attempts to bring her art to the public, which have left her both hopeful and apprehensive. She is astounded by the art conservator's revelation that art, which she had assumed to be unchanging and enduring, is in fact organic and doomed to decay. The chapter describes her reactions to his message. Earlier on in the novel, after Althea returned to New York City from Block Island, she fell asleep reading Giorgio Vasari's famous chapter on Michelangelo in his Lives of the Artist, in which Vasari tells how, as a youth, Michelangelo was persuaded to try to pass off a sleeping Cupid as a classical sculpture in order to get more money for it. This forgery figures again in this chapter. And now I will begin. On the second Saturday afternoon in December, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, a crowd thronged the entrance to the exhibit on the Italian Renaissance. Althea ignored the snatches of other people's conversations around her and the buzzes from the headsets of those taking the self-guided audio tour. The best way to see art, she believed, is alone and in silence. She went straight past the milling clusters of viewers in the first gallery. I'll retrace my steps later, she decided. The second gallery was emptier. In one corner, on a raised platform, were 16th century furnishings, an inlaid table, a heavy chair with carved arms and feet, and, against a backdrop of draped tapestry, a small statue of a sleeping Cupid set on a chest. On the wall was a photograph of the same furnishings in the room they apparently came from. Althea read the description attached to the photograph. A private study, or studiola, was an indispensable cultural symbol for a Renaissance ruler, the one constructed by Isabella d'Este in her apartments in the Castello di San Giorgio in Mantua was among the most famous. In this study, and in the neighboring room, known as the Grotta, she amassed a notable collection of antiquities, as well as paintings and sculpture by modern artists. Among the antiquities was a marble figure of Cupid asleep on a lion's skin, optimistically ascribed to Praxiteles. Opposite it, Isabella installed another sleeping Cupid, this one by Michelangelo, who had passed his work off as an ancient sculpture. In the description, Althea recognized with growing excitement Michelangelo's early sculpture, which she had read about in Vasari. She recalled that the cardinal who had bought the Cupid was outraged to discover that it was not an antique. She wondered if the savvy Isabella had acquired the sculpture directly from him, or if there had been other owners in the interim. It was the curator's guess, considered Althea, whether the sleeping Cupid in the exhibit resembled Michelangelo's classical forgery. She remembered how, the night she had returned from Block Island, she had lain in bed, imagining the subject of Michelangelo's snow sculpture for Piero de' Medici. She felt suddenly strange, as if there were a connection for her to grasp that she was barely missing. Was it about the Block Island paintings? For now, at last, she had completed them. On the Friday after Thanksgiving, she had returned to New York from Connecticut early in the morning. She worked through the weekend. On Sunday, she laid down her brush and said aloud, "I'm done." Now, a week later, she was trying to put those paintings behind her by looking at this exhibit of great art. In front of her, on loan from Paris, was Andrea Mantegna's Ecce Homo. Bound for crucifixion, crowned with thorns, Christ stared out of the canvas, pale and gold, his head and torso rendered as stone. To Althea, the scratches on his flesh were like striations in marble. Of all the paintings, drawings, and prints in the exhibition, it was this one, haunting and severe, which captured her most. The sacred and the profane, this is the great dichotomy, she thought. Once almost all art was for sacred purposes, now almost none of it is. The conventions, the subjects, the iconography are no longer a common language. What has 20th century abstraction lost by purifying itself of these associations, Althea considered as she left the exhibit. Now that abstraction is going out of style, some artists have returned to figurative painting, but they parody the conventions and warp our sacred language to political statement. As much as the message, it's their execution I dislike, so often blatant, didactic, and ugly, she concluded. As Althea walked along the balcony above the museum's great hall, absorbed in these judgments, she overheard an exchange without intending to. It concerned a lecture on art conservation that was apparently soon to take place. The subject piqued her interest, and she interrupted the speakers, two women, to inquire. One, thin and strong-looking, with iron-gray hair and startling light blue eyes, directed Althea towards the information desk in the lobby. "Better hurry," she said, shooing Althea along with a gesture of her hand. As Althea obeyed, she heard the second woman say to the first, in a low voice evidently not meant for Althea's ears, "But she won't be able to get in." Because of her resistance to that comment, Althea persisted after a young man at the information desk with a bored and languid manner motioned her to the museum's education offices with a limp wave of his hand. "This must be your lucky day," said another man with more energy. "Seats for this lecture sold out months and months ago. It's part of a series that's very difficult to get into. Robin Bromley, who gives the lectures, is the head of the Met's Paintings Conservation Department. Students, professionals, and connoisseurs from all over the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic attend these lectures. But it just so happens that I've had a cancellation, not 5 minutes ago. If you like, I'll sell you the ticket." "Sell? I thought the lectures were free." "Oh, no, not this one. You must be thinking of our public programs. A ticket to a single lecture in this series costs $30. "I appreciate the offer, but I can't afford it," Althea admitted, ashamed. She could feel his gaze on her, and she looked back at his dark eyes and curly dark hair. "Oh, go ahead, take the ticket," he said. "It's already paid for anyway." "Do you mean it?" He shrugged his shoulders. "Why not?" She didn't hesitate. "Thank you so much. I'm very grateful. I'll promise I'll listen to every word." As he handed over the ticket, he announced, "There'll be a test afterwards," with such a perfectly straight face that she was nearly taken in. The auditorium was almost full. She sensed anticipation as she took a seat at the back. There was a sudden hush as a man entered the stage and stood at the podium. This, apparently, was Mr. Bromley, 50-ish, stocky and square-shouldered, with thinning hair. It was hard for her to make out his features from where she sat in the last row. He spoke with an English accent. His voice was assured, sonorous, cultured. "This lecture will continue from our lecture last week about the ravages of time and the sins of previous conservators. Irreversible changes due to time and irreversible changes due to the mistakes of previous conservators. Our function is to care for the pictures, and in the fullest possible sense. A conservator is like a doctor looking at a patient. We should never forget that we're dealing with something alive, and anything we do is a threat to the life of the picture. This idea that a painting is alive, some people find strange, although it's commonplace in the other interpretive arts. Can you imagine a musician looking on a Bach concerto as something dead, or an actor playing Shakespeare by rote? Our approach is not clinical, however, but one of warmth, since we've all come into this field because the pleasure we get out of the visual arts is the greatest thing in our lives. A murmur of assent rose from the audience. "Paintings are like people," Mr. Bromley continued. "They start to die as soon as they are born." Althea's attention was riveted by this idea, but she dared not pursue it, lest she miss some of the lecture. Mr. Bromley was elaborating. "The paint begins to deteriorate the moment the artist lays down his brushes. The colors start to change, and the tones alter one to another. If you look at early Italian and Flemish paintings, you find that the landscapes are always autumnal. You might imagine there is some iconographical reason for this, but actually it's because the greens, which are copper resinate, have oxidized and turned brownish. For a similar reason, in the early religious paintings where the Virgin is depicted, we lose the azure blue of her robe. The color blue had an immense mystique in the Middle Ages, but since blue pigment was often azurite, lapis lazuli being too expensive for ordinary use, it gradually oxidized and turned greenish or even black. With time, and often with misguided treatment, the original values of the picture change markedly. The shadows darken and the details become less visible. It's very much like going to a symphony concert and hearing the bass muffled. After 400 or 500 years, the changes in paintings are so great that many an artist, if he could see his own work, would be hard-pressed to recognize it. The thing to understand is that you can't mummify a painting. Changes occur. There is a built-in death. One has to recognize that, although it is a desperately sad thing, a painting won't last forever. In spite of her determination to listen, Althea found herself thinking, if painting is such an evanescent art, and my pictures are bound to decay and disintegrate, why have I focused my hopes on the future? Is it just ignorance, or is it a way not to mind so much my exclusion from the present? Shrinking from this unhappy thought, she summoned her attention back to the speaker, who was progressing with his other topic, the sins of conservators. Many restorers in the past destroyed masterpieces. It was just brute force and inexcusable ignorance. Among their crimes must be included painting relining. It's a great shame that most old paintings have lost their impasto or surface relief almost entirely. That's because, sooner or later, the canvas rots and the painting has to be relined. In the past, the new canvas was stuck to the back of the original with a glue adhesive, which hardened after having been pressed with a hot iron. Sometimes the paintings were ironed, both front and back, and naturally that crushed the surface. There are some other physical ills which restorers try to deal with. One of the most serious things that happens to a painting is what happens to the varnish, which is used to enrich the tonal values and act as a protective film. Varnish lasts an amazingly short time, only 20 or 25 years, sometimes as few as 15, and then the resin oxidizes and becomes semi-opaque. After 50 years, the painting is very much obscured and all the colors are falsified. So you have this appalling thing called the cleaning cycle, in which the old varnish is removed and a fresh coat applied. It's an enormously serious operation in which the life of the painting is at stake. Insensitive removal of these oxidized surface coatings often does irreparable damage, and even the most careful work irremediably harms the paint surface. It's an unfortunate fact that the greater the painting, the more it has been damaged by repeated cleanings. Every generation wants to take a fresh look at a masterpiece, and so cleaning is frequent. For that reason, second and third-rate paintings tend to outlive the great ones. People think of cleaning a painting as the removal of dirt. They think it's either on or off. But a paint surface is much more porous than the layman imagines, and it's nothing to do with dirt. You're taking off an organic layer, like skin. Althea felt an increasing dread wash over her as he spoke. How ignorant she was! Unlike the painters of medieval times who learned their craft during years of apprenticeship, modernism celebrated the visionary artist, the individualist. It occurred to her now that much was lost in valuing artistic self-expression to the exclusion of craft. While restorers today had much more knowledge of artists' materials than in the past, it seemed that artists had much less. Her attention continued to wander. She began to review her mission of finding a gallery to represent her, a mission she had half-heartedly begun with Jean at her side for support and which had been interrupted by Paul's accident. But, she remembered, it was this accident that had motivated her to finish the Block Island paintings at last and to go ahead with the search for a dealer. If Paul could be struck down so senselessly, who knows what might happen to me? She thought. What am I waiting for? I can't let my fear of rejection keep paralyzing me. Once she'd made up her mind, she'd been in a rush to get slides of her work, to do everything the way she thought it should be done, only to discover the hard way that once she had the slides, it didn't mean that anyone would ever want to look at them. During the last several days, she had spent considerable time going to gallery after gallery, only to be told by a haughty young woman or man her age or younger to leave her slides, which she had stuck in the pockets of a plastic storage sheet, and eventually someone would contact her. Each time, Althea had seen her slides being put away without a glance into a drawer or box with lots of other slides. On Friday afternoon, as she entered the last gallery on her list, the George Clark Gallery on Green Street, it seemed to her that all she had done that day was offer her slides to a void. She felt consigned to oblivion. She was determined not to give up the one sheet of slides she had left to the impeccably groomed and snobbish assistant who asked for them. By pure luck, or perhaps fate, Hannah Clark herself, white-haired and straight as a stick in high heels, happened to come out of her inner sanctum just as Althea was preparing to leave. "Who is this, Alexis?" Hannah Clark asked her assistant, as if Althea couldn't speak for herself. Alexis asked Althea her name and then repeated it after her. "No translation is necessary," Althea said. "We're all speaking English." Then Hannah Clark looked at her. A smile broached the elderly woman's imperious face. "So we are," Hannah Clark said. Althea heard the trace of an accent she couldn't place. "What do you want?" This time Hannah Clark questioned Althea directly. "I want you to look at my slides." "Lay them down on the light table." Althea was so unprepared for this response that she didn't react. After Hannah Clark repeated herself, Althea obeyed her, feeling that she couldn't bear to watch her slides being examined. She looked away. After a pause, Hannah Clark began to question her about the paintings represented in the slides, the Block Island series and five others, and about the rest of her work. Althea tried to answer straightforwardly. Hannah Clark expressed no opinions. Then she said, Expect us at your studio on Monday. That's the day the gallery is closed. We'll be there at 4 p.m. sharp." She turned to the assistant. "Take down the address." Althea couldn't believe her ears. "What? Do we indeed speak the same language?" Hannah Clark commented. "I said we'll come by to look at your work next week, on the 15th. I'm usually prompt. I take tea in the late afternoon," she added. "So do I," Althea replied. After that, she had left the gallery immediately. She was afraid that Hannah Clark would change her mind. In the Metropolitan Museum Lecture Hall, as she relived the surprising interview, Althea even wondered if she'd imagined it. "If the gallery takes me on, it'll be like winning a ticket in the lottery," she decided. Absorbed in examining her feelings, she suddenly realized that she'd missed a lot of the lecture, in spite of what she had promised her benefactor with the ticket. It seemed that a change in the speaker's voice had brought her back to the present, and she roused herself in time to hear his final words. Essentially, I'm a pessimist. Time wins in the end. But that doesn't mean that we have to help it along. I'm continually amazed, Mr. Bromley concluded, that anything has come down to us at all. Althea left the museum with the sense that she was experiencing a change of heart. A lecture which she had attended by sheer accident was causing her to rethink her attitudes towards art, towards her own creations. Most artists, she realized, live in the present much more than she had. She was thinking of Michelangelo, of his youthful Cupid and his mysterious snow sculpture, of his ease at the beginning of his career and his obduracy at the end, when, after having pleased others, he could no longer please himself. As always, when she reflected on the giants, she felt small in comparison. Tonight, though, the thought was a solace. Obscurity can be a relief, she reflected. Obscurity is not necessarily failure. I wonder if I can manage to please myself and Hannah Clark. Outside the museum, it was dark. Althea looked at the lights up and down Fifth Avenue and the streams of lights from cars in swift motion. It seemed to her that she was re-entering the flow of her life, which had somehow been stopped inside the museum. She walked quickly down the long flight of steps. On an impulse, she paused at the bottom to look back. The museum seemed to drift and dissolve, a mirage insubstantial as air. Just imagine, she said to herself, all those paintings locked within but not sealed from time, in slow but inevitable deterioration. What, in my ignorance, I had assumed was permanent is actually in flux. She pictured building, paintings, precious objects disintegrated into dust. As she stood thinking, a father and son passed her. Their exchange flew out to her in the night. Why do you like New York City so much? The boy asked. Because everything is here, his father replied. How strange, Althea thought, that these words should land on me like a gift, just as I was imagining a scene of vast destruction where all trace of what had been is eroded away. Yet she did not feel despair at this barren prospect. In a way, it was strangely consoling. What would it matter then, she thought, if once everything was here? But it was nearly impossible to believe that this great fortress with all its treasures would disappear. No, the Metropolitan would continue to consolidate and conserve its collections, and she, with anxiety and hope, would show Hannah Clark her paintings on Monday. For Teachers and Writers Collaborative, I'm Ann Whitehouse. Fiction in the Morning is directed by Tom Ronan and produced by Erwin Gonshack in the studios of WNYE-FM, New York.